Crazy Buddhist, a conversation about Buddhist ideas, Buddhist teaching, Buddhism in the real world with Reverend Jerry Hirano. As we approach Halloween, an American and European festival associated with the folklore of ghosts and the dead, we thought we'd talk about one idea associated with Buddhism, and that's the hungry ghost, the being that is always hungry and never satisfied. As always, we'll hear from Reverend Hirano, the minister at the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple. We're joined for this conversation by Dr. Carmela Havayana Hirano, who is a psychiatrist practicing in Bountiful, Utah. The hungry ghost may be a figure of mythology, but it's not hard to recognize them in some of the people we see, and maybe even ourselves. I'm Dan Bomas. Delighted you could join us today. Ghosts. You know, there's all kinds of stories about ghosts from every culture. But there's one idea that is peculiar to Buddhism, although it may be in pre-Buddhist Asian mythology as well, the idea of the hungry ghost. But Jerry, what is a hungry ghost? Where does the idea come from?
The hungry ghost in Japanese, you call it gaki. And the most famous story of gaki is from Buddha's disciple Ogallana, so it goes way back to that time, that at our temple, in Buddhist temples, they hold a festival called Obon, the Ulumbana festival. And it's all based on the story that Buddha's disciple, when his mother died, searched for where she was at. And he was shocked to find out that she had become a hungry ghost, a gaki. And it's one of the six realms of existence. In Buddhism, there are jigoku, hell, gaki, hungry ghost, chikshou, beasts, ashira, fighting demons, ningen, human beings, and then tenjin, heavenly beings. These are all the realms that we're constantly moving through. And some people would say through lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes. And it's all driven by our desires, our bonno, our greed, anger, and ignorance. But gaki is a specific type the most Asian ghost stories are based on. Probably the most famous ones that we might have heard here in the United States of Japanese ghosts are by this man by the name of Lafcadio Hearn, that was American who moved to Japan, took the name Koizumi Yakumo, and he wrote about one of his famous ghost stories is about the corpse eaters. They're called jinkiniku, another name for gaki. And they're driven by this insatiable desire. Like you said, they're said to have huge bodies, little tiny throats, and so they're constantly hungry for more and more. So we say that this exists in the human realm, that you can also see it by the way people act, their insatiable desire for more. Like I've often given the description that Las Vegas is the world that gaki built. Because if you were satisfied, you wouldn't push that button again on the jackpot for more, more, more. You win $20. It's like, no, I think I can make 100. So you put in 200 to try to get your 100 and you just want more and more and more. And I think that's the same thing with food addiction, alcohol addiction, any type of addiction that we experience in this world. But in the Buddhist realm, if you looked at the traditional wheel of life where these realms of existence are often displayed, in each of these realms, there's always a bodhisattva, which means like whatever hell you find yourself in, there is a way to move beyond that. And so for most all the Asian ghosts, you'll find somehow it connects to this idea of gaki or hungry ghost. Chinese, Japanese, Korean, almost all the ghosts that you find, the various yokai and yurei that you hear about, have something to do with this continuous desire for more. And that's the basis for the hauntings that they talk about.
Mm-hmm. When you see a ghost, it's some need that's not satisfied.
Right, right. So they say that, you know, sometimes it goes beyond this world. It continues to drive that person into other realms of existence. So I think it's, you could see it in this world. The most specific, like we talked about, is in addictions that people have in this world. It's that same concept that this idea of ghost comes from in Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. Carmela, addiction is manifest in many different ways in our human experience. And do you think it's a fair comparison to look at addiction in the context of this Buddhist idea of the hungry ghost?
Oh, absolutely. On two measures. The first one is we are genetically wired to crave. We are genetically wired to desire things that we are never really satisfied with much of anything. And it's probably one of the primary drives that move us from place A to place B. But the other aspect of it is the pathological definition of addiction, which is continuing to engage in behavior despite its negative consequences and repeating this behavior over and over and over again because this individual is now seeking either reward, which is stronger than not having whatever that is, but it can also be driven by fear and the need to get away from fear into a more rewarding headspace.
Well, there's normal needs. We all need to eat. And typically when you eat, you're satisfied until, you know, your stomach's empty and you need to eat again. But in some people, it's not just satisfying hunger. Other needs trigger a neurotransmitter response, dopamine.
Absolutely.
In the brain.
Yes.
And it's easy to get addicted to that. I mean, happens to me when people like my Facebook posts.
And all the likes that you get.
Uh-huh. And I realized that was creating kind of a compulsion in me at one point. But with people using drugs, with people... And I guess there's also a negative reinforcement that can lead to addiction. If people, for example, are in an abusive environment, the need to escape, the need to not confront their abuser becomes something of a compulsion as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's really driven by more than just the dopamine hypothesis. It's also driven by other neurotransmitter systems in the brain, particularly serotonin, and also norepinephrine. The function of serotonin is to soothe the brain so that intrusive and recurrent preservative thoughts are not quite as sticky, that people can relinquish these thoughts quite a bit easier. But the aspect of norepinephrine has everything to do with attention. And often people with addictions have difficulty turning their attention away from what is rewarding. So you might say that addictions have two components. One is impulsive, meaning the difficulty in restraining oneself from engaging in a behavior that is potentially harmful. But there's also a compulsive aspect to it, which appears like this irresistible urge to go with the substance or the craved object.
I can't stop. I can't help myself. I got to do this.
Exactly.
And that is that the norepinephrine talking?
That's the dopamine talking. And every time I see it, I want it. That's norepinephrine.
Okay.
Because I'm miserable and I don't want to be miserable. So I would rather escape from this misery, and that's the lack of serotonin.
One of the big points of Buddhist practice, Jerry, is to train our attention, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, and it's also to try to get rid of the ego self. That's why that original ghost story I was talking about, of the Buddha's disciple finding his mother in the realm of the hungry ghosts, Moggallana said that, how could my mother, who was such a good person, be reborn in this realm of hungry ghosts. And it was because her ego was not just about herself. Her ego was also her son. So she had created this, like you said, karma, these actions for the sake of her son, which was an extension of her own ego to satisfy that. So in thinking she's trying to help her son, something selfless.
She was a stage mother, as it were.
Right. But it's any parent, you know, for your child, you think nothing is too good for my child. When you see another child, you don't think that same feeling. And that's the extension of our ego, which creates these monsters, so to speak.
Well, I had a son who won a national championship in archery. And it was almost as though I had won it myself, even though I didn't shoot a single arrow.
Absolutely.
You know, it was really great. And it's hard to shake yourself loose from something like that.
Right. That's why you yourself, I'm sure, can empathize with that notion of stage mother. Because all of us who have children, you feed off your child's success in that way. As you said, some parents, though, they take it beyond that they weren't able to do it, so they kind of push their children into living through them. And so, you know, it's another monster, like I said.
That's what creates the hungry ghost manifesting itself as the dad on the sideline screaming at the soccer referee.
Yeah, really. That's exactly it. That's why I said most of the stories of ghosts and monsters come from this need to feed the ego, that it's never satisfied. We always want more. And that's what Buddhism is trying to do, is to try to calm the ego, but at least see it. At least see yourself as that monster. And maybe that can help.
Hey, Carmela, the people that you see in your practice are typically miserable about something. That's the whole reason they seek out your services.
Absolutely, yes.
But don't you see people who are absolutely sure there's nothing wrong with me? I am the bomb, you know, or the bombest. I don't know, but I nothing wrong with me, and I need no help from nobody. Those people, do they come to you at all for treatment?
Well, the only reason that they would come and see me is because they were forced by a significant other to come and see me. But they usually don't stick around. It's the ones who are really miserable, who are able to acknowledge their misery, that seem to want this solution. They have this hunger, which in a way you might say it's also a form of craving. They have this hunger for relief.
They don't want the emotional pain any longer.
Oh, yeah.
And someone who insists that they feel no emotional pain, being at all honest with himself?
Well, no, I don't think so. But, you know, there are ego defenses that keep those feelings hidden.
How could you or would you work with someone like that?
Whose ego defenses are so thick?
Yeah.
That's really quite a process, because if they're not motivated to change because they are not in touch with their suffering, it's very difficult to be engaged, for them to be engaged in a therapeutic process, because if it's not broken, then don't fix it.
But the first noble truth of Buddhist teaching is that everyone experiences suffering.
Unless they are in an incredible state of denial, which happens quite a bit.
Then do people who have been in that position come to you perhaps after a disaster?
Yes.
A family suicide or death or a business failure or something like that?
Oh, yes. Oftentimes they encounter a crisis that, quote, wakes them up to their reality. And then they become more serious about how they view themselves. And sometimes they question who they are, what their identity is. You know, they recognize their mistaken notions of who they thought they were, which is great. Someone said, never let a crisis go to waste.
meaning that when you experience a crisis, there's an opportunity, and you've all heard the old saw about the Chinese word for crisis, which means both danger and opportunity. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true or not, but
yeah, I think it's weiji. I have a poster in my office with those Chinese characters that say weiji
for danger and opportunity.
Crisis and opportunity, meaning. Same thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that Jerry something that can be taught, or do you have to experience the 2x4 across the head to somehow or other realize that all is not what you had imagined?
I think you have to experience it yourself. Like, I think of my own addictions, and I smoked for close to 40 years. You know, going up to maybe 3-4 packs a day at one point. And then I quit by using that vape, and now they say the vape's bad, but I started cutting down on the nicotine until I was basically just sucking in flavored steam, and I thought, this is stupid. You know, I've spent how many thousands and thousands of dollars just to do this, and now I'm just doing steam, and then seeing my own stupidity was the only thing that finally made me stop, besides Carmela being upset with my smoking, my kids not liking me to smoke also helped, but I don't think that would have even done it. It was seeing how stupid this addiction was, just to suck this thing into my lungs. It was killing me, basically.
Well, nicotine, though, is one of the most addictive substances known. It's the one, Carmela, isn't it, by which others are measured?
It seems like it, but in my practice, when they have a smoking addiction, they often also have other addictions on top of that.
Is it because it just feels good?
Well, I think that some people have a tendency to be drawn to reward. And to drive away from punishment, more so than others. So I think it's a matter of degree, maybe based on their genetics and certainly based on their circumstances that they grew up in.
Some people have a genetic susceptibility to alcohol, too,
absolutely.
Don't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
So it's not just that we love that dopamine rush.
Oh, yeah. It's biological as well. But the problem is that when people start to engage in an addictive behavior, well, you've heard of the word gateway drug, right?
Right.
I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, because I think there are already predispositions prior to actually the addiction taking root or taking off in an individual. So there are personality or biological predispositions that precede the full onset of an addiction.
I'm reminded of the old poem, "Tobacco is a filthy weed. I like it. It serves no known human need. I like it." And people who smoke are often fully aware of the consequences. But they do it anyway. They do it anyway. Mm-hmm. What is the key to breaking free of that? And is that lesson applicable to not just a nicotine addiction, but others?
Well, I think part of it is how badly one is punished by one's addiction. And oftentimes, people in this population appear to have a fairly high tolerance for punishment.
The techniques that would work to get free of a chemical addiction, like nicotine, would work for other characteristics like sex or an abusive type of relationship.
Yeah. When we interview somebody with an addictive diagnosis, whether it's sex or the internet or electronics or work, we always ask what this addiction does for you, that benefits you. And also we ask, how does it harm you? How has it interfered with your life?
And what kind of answers do you get?
So that they can see both sides. Well, oftentimes people will say they derive some satisfaction from it. It makes them feel calmer. They're happier when they use. But then when you ask them about the negative consequences, it's often costing their relationships, their intimate relationships, their families, their spouses, their work, their jobs.
And powerful motivations there. But Jerry, in Buddhist practice, and I don't mean to discount your view on this subject, Carmela, so please answer this too if you'd like. But in Buddhist practice, how can you address these issues and what goes beyond standard psychotherapy?
Well, kind of depends on the sect of Buddhism, but for most Buddhists that practice meditation, it's, as you said, to focus on it, be able to attend it. Whereas in Jodo Shinshu, it's more realize that these difficulties you have, you can't get through it on your own. It requires something else, a greater power. That's why I think that the 12-step program, which is an addiction recovery program, one of the points of that is always to rely on a higher power. You know, the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, most all the drug 12-step programs have that idea of the other. So you're helped to get through this by the other. And that's why I said in Buddhism, within each of those realms of existence, there's always a bodhisattva. There is someone always there whose will embrace you. But when you meditate, it's to focus and have attention on those things that cause difficulties.
So most of my patients have difficulty with mindfulness practice because their minds are too restless. And we've tried it in session, and it helps to some extent. But in my experience, there hasn't seemed to be really any lasting effects from meditation practice because it's incredibly difficult to discipline yourself to sit and notice your breath, much less let go of your addiction, which requires even more discipline. And also the 12-step program, I think, is helpful for a lot of people, but it's not for everyone. My patients who refuse to be a part of the AA or the NA groups basically tell me that they cannot relate to the people who are there because they are far worse than I am. Or two, they feel like they're being denigrated and pushed down, put down even more, that it just defeats the purpose for them. So there have to be other ways to deal with addiction. In my practice, what I've found to be really helpful is really more the Jodo Shinshu model, which is listening. And what we do is we review the life history of this individual all the way back to their childhood. So when we piece their story together, and when they tell me about their life story, they get to hear themselves. And when they hear themselves, when they listen to their own dialogue, at some point they begin to realize some of the distortions in their own beliefs, or they start to realize the folly of their actions. And to me, that's a very important piece of psychotherapy, is just to listen to what your patients are telling you. Because somewhere along there, a light seems to go on here and there that illuminates their consciousness that they may not have been aware of before. And so they themselves sometimes are surprised at what comes out of their mouths.
There's a version of the second noble truth in Buddhism, which is that our suffering begins when we believe the story that we tell about ourselves.
Yes.
Do you think that has some validity?
Oh, absolutely. One really famous writer on trauma said that our trauma comes from the lies that we tell ourselves. He wrote this book called The Body Keeps the Score. And I'm struggling on recalling his name.
Well, folks can look it up, I'm sure. But Jerry, you think that you were nodding your head. You agree with that idea.
Yes. Yeah, I do.
Oh, yeah, I remember. His name is Besser van der Kolk.
Okay. And what does he say in this book? The body keeps the score, meaning?
The body keeps the score, meaning that all of us experience trauma to some extent. And we think that it's more of a mental issue, but it actually becomes a physical issue as well. Our bodies remember the experience of trauma without any words. And so they manifest as certain physical symptoms, like shortness of breath or pain, or even allergies, breaking out in hives.
Or anxiety, which would be a very typical manifestation.
Migraines, yeah. Mm-hmm. Heartburn, right? High blood pressure. Asthma.
Well, I think the idea of haunted, right? Since we started this whole thing with ghosts, haunted could be generational. So this trauma that Carmela is talking about, science has now shown the trauma is generational, that it carries on for many generations after it happened, and it's within the body itself that it manifests. So we're haunted by this past even without even knowing it.
And that plays back into the idea of karma, that we're not punished for our sins, we're punished by our sins. And the burdens that we carry, we pass along to our kids.
And we are also punished by our predecessors' sins. And that's why I think it's really important to review one's life history that goes back at least three generations.
The foo-foo stuff, the family of origin.
Absolutely, all the family myths and stories and people talk about over Thanksgiving table about Uncle Henry, you know, smashing his head on the wall or whatever. But once people begin to understand the origins of their own behavior, they can make up a more conscious effort to change. So the motivation for change, I think, necessarily has to come from the individual and not from the therapist.
Jerry, have you seen the pictures in Japanese art of hungry ghosts?
Yes. That's the one I think of whenever I think of Gaki is a traditional picture of Mogalana's mother, that she's just emaciated except for her body. In fact, I have a story I've told many times during our Obon season about Orlando, the Obon ostrich, dancing ostrich, because it's almost like an ostrich, right? With the small, skinny neck and the big body that is never filled. So that's the image I have when we talk about Gaki. But then if you look at a lot of Chinese ghost stories, you will see them based on these. Sometimes there's the word gaki. It's a way Japanese also refer to little children as constantly hungry. So in a lot of these Asian ghost stories, you'll see these little children ghosts that are out there eating the offerings put on the Buddhist altars. Those are also images of the gaki.
Well, in Korea, Japan, China, there's a tradition of, in Korean, it's called chesa, ancestor worship. That, I guess, plays into this idea.
Yes, that's where it comes from. It's this whole idea of appeasing the ancestors.
And you know what's really funny to me, how ironic it is that during Halloween, we feed these kids with tons of candy. We're feeding their hungry ghosts. And then the rest of the year, you know, we don't allow them to eat anything. I mean, it seems to me like a fairly conflicted, confused message that we're giving our kids.
You're training them to be hungry ghosts.
Training them to be hungry ghosts, yes.
We used to use Richard Dawkins, I think, was the author who wrote The Selfish Gene. Mm-hmm. And he showed how, as Carmela said, we're wired to be gaki at a genetic level. If it didn't constantly want more, 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 we wouldn't evolve. So he's saying
evolution. Which may have been a survival adaptation.
Right.
10,000 years ago, and it doesn't help us now.
Well, even now, I think it's a survival mechanism, and I think that's the basis of other forms of addiction that we often don't recognize, like workaholism, the desire to always be busy, shopaholism, right? Shopping, acquiring things.
Looking at your cell phone
constantly. Looking at your cell phone at all hours of the day, which is really a major concern right now for parents with their young kids because they're exposed to electronics from a very young age. And we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing to temper the gawky within ourselves? And I think a lot of that really has to do with where you have to draw the line between survival and pathology.
But can we be the bodhisattva for someone? I mean, it's easy to see how we can become the gawky. But can we become the bodhisattva that helps you find your way out of this?
I don't think you could ever become the bodhisattva with the intent to become the bodhisattva, because that alone is the ego. But by accident, you may be. Your modeling may help the other. Maybe the bodhisattva that pulls that person out. I've often give the example that some of my greatest bodhisattvas have been those people that I dislike the most.
For example?
Well, I don't know if I should. I've always used the example of an ex-wife. I said an ex-wife has shown me the bad part of myself. Because that ex-wife, although it's an ex-wife, someone I don't get along with, it's made me aware of what a bad person I can be when I let that just come out, right? So she becomes my greatest bodhisattva. Without her intending to become my bodhisattva, she is.
Or maybe the coach who's constantly on you, but you perform at your best when you do what he or she is telling you?
Yeah.
Or really, I think for me, the most significant bodhisattvas are my kids. They're the ones that point out all the horrible things about me as a parent that I have to pause and think about more closely. You know, it's like, how do my children hate me so much like that? And for some parents, maybe that's too threatening to their sense of authority as parents. But I've learned that for me, it's an opportunity for self-examination that I have hurt this person who I call my child, who I dearly love. And so I have to look at myself and see what I'm doing.
Do we see the gawky in the mirror?
That's what's maybe the most difficult, but the most important, is to see it in yourself, that it's something that's there, that you are the gawky. But there is, I think you always have to put in hope. There's always hope that there's to get out of that realm, at least for a little while. And I think that aspiration and that trying is important.
One of the steps on the Eightfold Path, right? Effort.
Right.
Yes. Yes. There's no such thing as right emotion, but there is right effort.
Right understanding, right effort, and, mm-hmm. and the whole list.
And I think that's part of the problem, too, in mental health circles, is that emotions are often judged as good or bad, desirable or undesirable. And to me, that's wrong thinking, because that's what human beings are made of. They're made up of very powerful emotions. So really, to that extent, we are also addicted to our emotions. We can be addicted to anger, you know, this righteous indignation, especially around the time of the presidential election.
Feels good to feel bad.
Yes. We get kind of snarky, you know, and it makes us feel good about that. So really, in my mind, addictions need to be further defined in a broader space rather than just chemicals. But because really, ultimately, we are addicted to our own egos.
But the idea of the hungry ghost is useful in understanding that.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Hirano Sensei is director of the Center for Buddhist Education for the Buddhist Churches of America. He's the minister at the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple in Salt Lake City, Utah, as well as supervising minister for temples in Ogden and Honeyville, Utah, and in Ontario, Oregon. Today's conversation included Reverend Carmela Javellana Hirano. Carmela is both a medical doctor, a psychiatrist, and an ordained minister in the Jodo Shinshu, or Pure Land tradition of Buddhism. She is the minister's assistant at the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple. She's been married to Jerry for the past 16 years. I'm Dan Bomas, and we're grateful you've taken the time to listen to Crazy Buddhist. Please leave us a rating or a review, and we'll be back soon.